Good morning. This is Chris English with a special Armistice Day edition of At Home This Morning, in which we'll be hearing from both the Royal British Legion and Blind Veterans UK as we remember those who fought and died for our freedom all those many years ago. Plus, of course, those who came home with horrific injuries, not just from the 1914-18 war, but from every conflict since that has changed their and our lives forever. In the next hour, the city's own Brian Capron will be taking a look at the story behind the making of the anti-war film Oh, What a Lovely War, a film that was mainly shot in and around the city 50 years ago. And we'll be hearing from Dr. Geoffrey Mead from Sussex University about what life was like in our city 100 years ago. But first I spoke to the Royal British Legion's Mark Edwards, and I first asked him how important it is that we still continue to remember.
Extremely important. Remembering what happened is just as important as the events themselves. Remembering that these young men and women, I mean, were literally, due to national service and the way it worked, they had no choice. That was it. That's what you did. You fought for your country, and obviously, as we all know, a lot of the people that did fight for the country unfortunately lost their lives. It's definitely worth, and not just worth, I mean, but it's so important to remember, because history does repeat itself, and not talking about this will mean that it's forgotten. And one day history may repeat itself again, but unfortunately with what there is out there now, it might be the end of the human race due to nuclear warheads and all that sort of stuff that we've got, and whoever is in power at the time. The Royal British Legion, we work really, really hard not just to support veterans and families of veterans all year round, but we work even harder when it comes to remembrance to make sure that these stories are still told, and be it the positive or negative. I mean, working here, not everyone I speak to in the way of veterans has had a negative outcome from conflict. They've met some of the best friends they've ever had. They've met family members, they've met their wives through service and all this sort of thing. So the stories that people do have to tell, yes, are positive and negative, and that's what we need to continue to do, talking about war and talking about conflict. They're out there. It is still happening today. So this is our way of making sure that people realise it does happen. And it's our way of helping people struggle through. There's plenty of wives and husbands and boyfriends and all that at the moment that are out there that are missing loved ones because they're still away at war. And I can only imagine what that must have felt like 100 years ago when things like mobile telephones and email wasn't around. So not being able to talk to your loved one for months and months and months at a time, and then realising one day that you get a letter through the post saying, unfortunately, you're never going to see them again, it must be absolutely just devastating. So we need to continue to talk about it, and we will remember them.
Is that part of what the Royal British Legion will continue to do?
Absolutely. We own Remembrance. There's a lot of charities out there that do fantastic work, either with us, for us, or alongside us. But the Royal British Legion are known. I mean, we own Remembrance, the poppy and all that sort of stuff. That's what we cover, that's what we blanket over. We help veterans all year round, and we continue to help veterans all year round and their families to obviously live their day-to-day lives financially with support and all that sort of stuff, but to let them know and to remind them that they're not on their own, and that, yeah, we'll hold the hand and we'll walk through life with them.
Of course, today we're remembering what happened 100 years and more ago, but things like the Invictus Games is bringing it to our forefront that this is still happening.
Absolutely correct. And funnily enough, one of our colleagues here from Brighton, who was based here in Brighton, she's actually over with the Invictus Games at the moment. She flew out with the guys, and she's supporting their friends and family, and she's doing incredible work. Yes, it is bringing it to our forefront, because there's men and women over there who are competing, who have lost limbs, they're suffering with mental health difficulties and all that sort of thing, but are still living their lives, and they're still winning gold medals and things like that. So it's a way of bringing it home that it can be okay, things can still be done, and life can still go on. But that's the name of the game with the Invictus. Again, it's a form of remembrance that, yes, conflict and things are there. This is what's happened. However, life can move forward. We can still keep going.
How important is it to have the backing of somebody like Prince Harry and his wife?
I think that's a huge, huge thing. I mean, especially with their recent great news about a little baby on the way, which is fantastic. Good for their congratulations for them. The backing of the royals, especially the youngest of all of the royals, I think that's a huge thing. I mean, the Queen is a significant forefront in everything you do day-to-day life here in this country and across the world. But to have the youngest of the sons really sort of stepping forward, and I know that David Beckham's a huge advocate of them as well, which is great, because, I mean, what young lad has ever turned around and said, oh, I don't want to be David Beckham one day because his football skills and all that sort of great stuff. So, yeah, to have someone as influential as that, I think it's a huge deal, absolutely huge, massive deal, yeah. So good on Harry. Thank you very much for supporting us as well.
And the ongoing conflict, I mean, as much as we might like to, I think wars will continue to happen, won't they?
Yes. I, from my personal point of view, I do strongly believe that wars will continue to happen all the time, that there is all these different things, that religion, oil, greed, people just tending to not be very nice people sometimes. I think war and conflict will always be there. Will it get any worse? I'd like to think not. As I've mentioned earlier, and as I've spoke to a few people about recently, the fact that there are that many nuclear devices and this, that and the others, and we've got certain people in power at the moment with the red button at their fingertips, it absolutely blows my mind that these people want to be able to do this, and the fact that they have that power just goes straight to their head and they feel okay threatening others with it. However, that's my personal opinion. And yeah, I mean, the only way we're ever going to stop war is if the human race is wiped out, which I think will be the next step if it happens.
A dreadful thought. But going back 100 years, and let's say Elmore, because it's actually the 104th anniversary of the start of the war.
Yeah.
Can you imagine why these hundreds of thousands of young men, mainly young men in those days, gave up everything and just went to war? What generated that desire to do it?
It's good old British stiff upper lip to start off with, I think. You fought back then, Queen and Country. I mean, unfortunately, these days it has slipped a little bit with technology and Facebook and all that sort of, kids don't go out and play anymore. I used to go out and ride my bike and scrape my knee, and that's what we used to do. Now children sit inside and their Xbox or whatever they play with these days. Back then you didn't have that. You did as you were told, and if mum and dad turned around and said to you, no, do this and do it this way, you agreed, yes, okay, that's going to be done. Society has changed. All I can do is thank the young men and women that did do that for us. And as I say, my way of saying thank you is to continue our work with Remembrance here at the Royal British Legion. As someone who's only 31 years old myself, I can only imagine that if it ever happened, I mean, even now, I would be absolutely petrified. To have it thrown at you at 16... No, I'm sorry, you're not doing this anymore. We're going to give you a gun and we're going to send you off to possibly never come home again. I mean, that just... I dread to think. I can't even comprehend personally what must be going through your head at that time. However, young men and women did it, and we've got to remember them and say thank you for that.
How important is the annual poppy appeal to that?
Hugely important. I wear a poppy every day. All year round, I always have, ever since I was a teenager. I'm from a service background myself, and I do get asked the question a lot, why are you wearing your poppy now? Shouldn't you be wearing it just in November? When can I start wearing my poppy, and when should I take it off? My attitude is, why can't you be proud every day of this great country and what these young men and women did for us? I'm proud every day, certainly. I'm proud to be working for the Royal British Legion and doing what we do. I'm proud of all of our volunteers here who do just as hard and just as big a job as I do. So yeah, it all comes down to, are you proud, and when do you want to be proud? There's no time limit on my pride, which is why my poppy's worn all year round.
Are volunteers still needed by the British Legion?
Absolutely, 100%. And as I've just said, and I will continue to say to anyone, my volunteers here at the Poppin in Brighton are just as important as the big wigs that we've got up at Hague House. Absolutely. I mean, the atmosphere that they create here in the Poppin is just tremendous. No one's ever too much trouble. We've always got the kettle on. They welcome people, they greet people. If they can help people themselves, they do just that without me even having to step in as the advice and information officer. 9 times out of 10, some people just want to come in for a bit of a chat and they don't know what the Royal British Legion is. If we've got people not from round Brighton or don't know what the Poppy is, or all of our volunteers here are widely, hugely knowledgeable on who we are and what we do as the Legion. So if one of my volunteers wants to sit down at the sofa having a cup of tea and just chatting about who we are and how we help people, then that's what we let them do, because they're spreading the word just as much as I do. I'm more sat emailing people, making sure things get happening, but spreading awareness about the great work that we do here at the Legion, yeah, that's my volunteers' work, and they do it fantastically.
And finally, is anybody welcome? Everybody welcome?
Anybody who is anybody is welcome at the Poppin here in Brighton. You can come in and you can talk to me about anything you like. It doesn't even have to be about the Legion. If you just want to come in because it's cold outside and you fancy a bit of a coffee and a chat to someone, go for it. Our doors are always open. As I say, the volunteers are here. If they're not here, one of us will be here. Members of management cover the hot desk at times during the day as well. No questions too silly, no needs too small or too large. We'll do whatever we can to help. And we've got some beautiful, beautiful merchandise this year for Remembrance. We've got all our new pins and badges and things in. And the most beautiful one that we've got is the Remembrance for the Women of World War One. Which has just come in. It's absolutely stunning. So I would say, if anything else, pop into the Brighton, pop in and have a look at our merchandise cabinets, because there's some really, really nice bits in.
And today? How important is today?
Extremely, extremely important. It needs to continue to be spoken about. It needs to continue to be remembered. Wear your poppy with pride. Come in and see us at the Brighton, pop in and just have a chat to us. And there's so much information that we've got here that just drives it home. These young men and women that were literally torn away from their families to march to the front, not remembering them would be a great disservice to them. So please, yeah, all get together, get down to the cenotaph, remember these people, read the wreaths, who's helping us remember. We're a community, we're a family, we should stay like that. We are an amazing nation. And no matter what's thrown at us, we tend to continue to bounce back. And it's through remembrance that we do that. So support the Poppy Appeal. And as I've said, come in and see me in the Brighton Poppin and have a brew.
I was talking to the Legion's Mark Edwards. Now, the large building that has dominated the Coast Road at Owing Dean for more than 80 years and is known to most locals as simply St Dunstan's, but has recently been renamed Blind Veterans UK, as this gives a better indication of the work that they now do. To find out more, I first spoke to Rehabilitation Officer Paul Hartley, who explains why remembrance is important.
It's an extremely important part of I think, every member's understanding of why the charity is important to them, but also their history. So many of the people that I work with have experienced a friend or someone that they've lost, or not only that, but also the understanding of what the sacrifices many people made and why it's important that people need to remember what's happened in the past.
Now, of course, the charity's got a new name, but being a Brighton resident, I still think of it as St. Dunstan's. Is that wrong?
Not at all. In fact, it seems like a new name, but actually we've been Blind Veterans UK since 2012. I've actually been with the charity since 2001, so my experience has been much more as St. Dunstan's. And I think it's absolutely lovely that people still think of St. Dunstan's as the name behind the charity. It's where our history lies, and there's such fantastic history around the work that the charity did to support servicemen, firstly in the First World War. And really, for me, the understanding of it is, I think that I still consider many of our members or our members as St. Dunstaners, and the charity itself as Blind Veterans UK, which in a way really lends itself to a greater understanding of what it is that we do and who we serve. Many of our members consider themselves to be St. Dunstans, and we are Blind Veterans UK.
It's 100 years since the armistice, and 80 years of St. Dunstan's. How has it changed in that 80 years?
Well, I think if we, it's actually 80 years for the building.
Yeah.
The St. Dunstan's itself was brought into being in 1915. So we've only, a couple of years ago, had our 100th anniversary as well. But certainly in the 80 years of the building, it's remarkable how little has changed, in a way, in that if we think about the principles that brought the charity together from our founding father, it was kind of the idea that that people, servicemen, would have an opportunity to have rehabilitation, to have purpose in their lives, and the sense of what we talk about now as victory over blindness was certainly there then, and it's as strong now. So the rehabilitation, the work that I do as a rehabilitation officer at Blind Veterans UK, I feel really is set in quite powerful sort of foundations of why the charity first came into being.
Presumably the numbers of incomers, new patients, has changed dramatically since the 1418 war, or has it?
Well, yes. I mean, fortunately, we're in a position now where we haven't seen the huge numbers of service men and women coming into the organisation in large numbers, as we saw in both the First World War and then latterly in the Second World War. And in fact, the numbers have reduced a lot. But if you look at it over a period of time, we're still talking about thousands. We currently support just over 4,700 members in the charity today, and our aspiration is to get to a potentially another 50,000 people out there, personnel, ex-personnel out there, who have sight loss, who would benefit from the work that we do and we can offer them.
The charity is far from redundant.
Anything but. I think for me, this feels like perhaps the one of the most exciting times for the charity, and seeing how it can grow. And it's very much about collaboration as well, and about how we can, nearly 20 years ago, we opened our doors up to not only service personnel that were blinded in action, but anybody who had lost their sight and had served. We're now looking again at how we can build on the excellent work that has been done over many years by the people who came before me. So yes, it's a very exciting time of growth.
You yourself are registered blind. Not that anybody would know, I have to say.
Yes.
So you can talk to the patients firsthand. Does that help?
Yeah, I mean, I certainly think that it's not a prerequisite to be a rehabilitation officer to be registered with a vision impairment. But yes, I mean, I've been registered with sight loss, and I've lived with sight loss for pretty much all of my life. It's a hereditary condition that I have. What that does is it lends some level of empathy, which or an understanding of some of the struggles. But on the other side of that, many of the members, if not all of them, that I work with, started their lives off with very good sight and actually experienced a loss. And my loss was more like a lack. I'd never had good vision, so I had to adjust, but in a slightly different way. And one of the things that we really work with our members, and certainly something I believe in very much, is that we have to learn to accept what's happened before we can really truly have a foundation of adjusting and achieving. So my sight loss, I've turned around and used as a sort of a beneficial tool to work with people, and it does really lend to helping with understanding, yes.
So there's life after sight loss?
There's life after sight loss, and in fact our mission is really to look at a victory beyond sight loss, and there certainly is life, not only a life but a very good life after sight loss as well.
I was talking there to Paul Hartley from the staff of Blind Veterans UK. Next I had a word with Falklands veteran Jerry Jackson, who explains what that conflict was like.
Of the Falklands itself, because I had been involved in conflicts earlier than that, but the Falklands, I was amazed at the speed with which things occurred. You know, one day I was in the UK, having just left the services and then been recalled. This is in April 82, and 2 days later I find myself arriving by boat in San Carlos in the Falkland Islands, and seeing aircraft flying around and bombing and rocketing, and wondering what on earth was going to happen. And at that time I also saw the HMS Antrim being strafed by these aircraft. The only person ever to be blinded, or who was blinded in the Falklands, Terry Bullingham, was on board the Antrim, and little did I know that 25 or so years later I would meet him here at was then St Dunstan's, now Blind Veterans.
And your memories of that conflict, do you not want to talk about them? Do you? Is it something you hide away in the back of your head?
Some of the things I can talk about, but the main reason why I was down there I can't talk about, because it was under the Official Secrets Act, but my main thoughts were the equipment which we had to work with didn't stand up well to the climate, etc., down there. I was also a bit upset when people were killed, some of whom I didn't think should have been. But all in all, it was a bit like a training exercise in the middle of Dartmoor.
Just as simple as that.
Yeah.
How important is it to you and your colleagues that there is an organisation like UK Blind Veterans?
Well, Blind Veterans, of course, which I joined when it was St Dunstan's, are there and assist us in any way, or any way that they is possible for us to lead our lives alone. Not alone. We don't have to rely on people. They train us here to do this. They've also now got fantastic machines which can do things whereby you replace your eyes. Everything is electronic. You think of anything that you need to do, and you have a machine to help you do it. It's a marvellous place. It changed my life. I often say to my grandkids that if it hadn't have been for this place, I wouldn't have been here anymore. I would have gone into a shell somewhere. I thought I might have been suffering a bit from this PTSD kind of thing, but I've grown out of that feeling now, mainly by coming in here 2 days a week and meeting other people.
And contact is important?
Contact's important. If you lose contact with people that you served with, you sort of separate. We have a situation now where I'm a member of the South Atlantic Medal Association, and also of associations from the service, where we all meet and we all discuss what went on. We all have dits, and we finish up laughing. And that's the great part of it. We don't dwell on what happened in a negative sort of sense.
How important is it that we continue to remember those that fell or were injured?
Well, I think it's important, not just fell or injured, but everybody who was in the service, which now comes under the title veteran. I think it's important that the service that they gave is recognised. We are a country which is probably the only one left of the big organisations where we don't have a veterans assistance programme. You know, Australia and America have a fantastic veterans programme. We don't have that here. We don't have anything at all, apart from a very small badge now, which you can wear, which I haven't got on today. There's nothing to show that you were in the services, in the arms. The government are now talking about an MOD 90, I think it is, some kind of identity card, which you can show. And I believe that there should be some kind of priority in certain things.
And the annual parade around the cenotaph and at war memorials, is that important?
Yeah. Be able to show the younger people of today that everybody still joins together, everybody still remembers. But I don't think it should be dwelled on that it's something to do with the 14-18. I think they do mention it in the broadcast that it's for everybody. But I'm not sure that a lot of people know that. I talk to people and they still think it's something to do with the First World War, or the Great War as they called it. But they don't realise that it's for all these others that we were involved with, even, you know, the Falklands, Borneo, all those places. They don't realise that it's for there as well.
And of course, everybody that took part in all of those conflicts are still about and still need help.
Oh yeah, I mean there are still people alive who served in Korea, there are still people alive from World War II. They're gradually disappearing, but we're going on and on. There'll always be people from, you know, Aden and all the places in the Middle East and the Far East, the Borneo and Brunei and all areas there, and the Falklands. It will go on, that people will still have to be aware of guys being away. And within here, of the modern times, the vast majority of people, new ones, come from Afghanistan. But then, the funny part about it, I've got comrades who served in Afghanistan, and because of the modern equipment, protective equipment, in particular Oakley glasses, we call them, the goggles, they're so good that very few people come in with eye problems. I know a guy who's lost three limbs and still got his sight thanks to these Oakley glasses. So the numbers of people are getting fewer and fewer for this charity, i.e. from an eye point of view. So it will now be coming from, well, once we run out of national servicemen, who knows, you know, what is likely to happen.
And a final word about UK veterans?
Well, UK blind veterans, to me, has gone through two eras. They're just different names, that's all. It hasn't changed very much. The only thing that I notice is that the same services are available, i.e. everything that you require to give you independence, to live independently, it's just better technology and more people who are doing it. But they, as I said before, they changed my life. Without here, without Blind Veterans St Dunstan's, I wouldn't have been here.
Now I'm joined in the studio by Dr. Geoffrey Mead from Sussex University, who first explained what life was like in the early part of the last century for Brightonians.
It was relatively peaceful in that people moved to Brighton to get away from London, which did suffer bombing. And my mother, who went to Park Street School, lived in the East End of London and remembered the Zeppelin raids. So Brighton was relatively safe. It was not madly different to today. Huge number of people involved in exactly the same things we do today, the service industries. Lots of people working in hotels, lodging houses, restaurants, shops. One of the big surprises, something very different to today, was the sheer number of people in laundries. Everyone these days, of course, has washing machines, but vast numbers of people, mostly women, involved in huge number of laundries across Brighton and Hove, as well as people doing a very basic working class thing in very poor districts, taking in washing.
What about the war memorials from 1418? I gather that you've been involved in a particular project.
Yes, I was working with a group from the Fabrica Art Gallery in Ship Street, which was the Holy Trinity Church. And that was going to be Brighton's local history centre back in the 1980s. It's a project that fell through. But in the course of turning it into a museum, they boarded up lots of plaques and memorials in the church. One was uncovered appropriately in 2014, and it was a triple plaque with one section showing you members of the Congregation of Holy Trinity who had served and sadly died, but the two plaques on either side showed you those who served and returned. So we had a pretty good idea of the range of people who had gone off to war from that congregation. And by using the census returns, local history, research, trade directories, street directories, worked out what their parents and they had been doing in the way of occupations. And out of that, we organised some tours and some talks based around the economy of the central lanes at that period.
How economically sound was Brighton in those days?
It was a very, very prosperous community. There was a lot more manufacturing than we had now. Some of them were growing industries. What became very familiar to older people in Brighton, Alan West, the electrical switchgear people, that had started as Reason Electrics in the early years before the war, and it expanded enormously with the military demands for electrical switchgear. So that was a huge expansion. The railway yards up in what is now the New England Quarter were employing nearly 6,000 people by the end of the war. And then, as I said before, there was a huge range of service industries. What was in very severe decline was the very basic industry in Brighton, the historic fishing industry, which was in real, it was just over 300 people involved in it. And at one time, of course, it had been the major trade in the town.
It was indeed. And talking about the seafront, in World War Two, of course, the seafront was unapproachable, wasn't it? It was
only one side of the seafront. The north side of the seafront, King's Road, still had the hotels, the nightclubs, the restaurants, and was very busy. South side of the road was military zone, and you had searchlights and gun emplacements, barbed wire, tank traps. But there was this dividing line. Basically, the King's Road was the dividing line between, the soldiers on one side and then the soldiers having a good time on the other side of the road.
The West Pier, of course, you've been involved in the West Pier.
Yeah, not 5 years I was a tour guide on the West Pier from 1997 until 2002. I did the weekend trips.
So you saw it in its heyday?
I remember it in its heyday when I was a child. Not in its heyday. Its heyday was just after the First World War and just after the Second World War. I remember it from the late 50s, early 60s, when it was always the West End Pier. It was always the pier you went on with your mum and dad and you behaved yourself, whereas you went on the Palace Pier with your mates and had a good time.
And Oh What a Lovely War, you weren't involved on the pier in that stage.
No, I was still at Brighton Grammar School when that was being produced. I was just in the process of taking exams. But I know one of my classroom colleagues was an extra in the filming.
And have you seen the film?
I have indeed, yes. It's very, very evocative, particularly so when you see just how beautiful the West Pier looked at that time. Of course, a lot of money had been spent on it to do it up for the filming. But just seeing the other bits of Brighton, like Sheepcote Valley, used for the battle scenes, and then the hillsides on the downs to the east covered in the crosses.
Very evocative indeed. We'll be hearing more about that a bit later on. Brighton, 1418... Was it a better time?
Almost certainly no. I don't think you can never look. I'm a historical geographer, and you can never look back on the past with anything other than I'm glad I didn't live there. You know, there was no National Health Service, huge amount of poverty. We're right on the edge here where we're doing the recording of the Hereford Street, Essex Street area, which is one of the most appalling slums in the Brighton area, one of the first bits to be demolished in the 1920s. So there was appalling housing conditions in Brighton, and you wouldn't want to live back in that time.
That was Dr. Geoffrey Mead from Sussex University, who was giving us an insight into life in Brighton in and around the time of the First World War. And as unlikely as it sounds, that awful conflict was to become the subject of both a stage musical and then a film. And to tell us all about that production, here's television's Coronation Street bad boy, Brian Capron.
Richard Attenborough's 1969 BAFTA award-winning film, Oh, What a Lovely War, owes its theme to the Joan Littlewood Theatre Workshop musical of 1963, in which there was a powerful use of satirical war songs, choreography, burlesque, and a passionate anti-war message. Oh, What a Lovely War is certainly of its time, and even today tells us as much about the 1960s as it does about the First World War. But it's certainly worth looking at again, as we remember those that fell a centenary on from the end of that war. When it opened in March 1963, it was an instant success, and later transferred to the West End and then on to Broadway. At that time, the First World War had then been out of fashion because of the Second World War. However, in the late 1950s and early 1960s, there was a rediscovery of the Great War with Stanley Kubrick's film Paths of Glory in 1958. Then, in 1964, BBC Two made the 26-part series The Great War, which was repeated later that year on BBC One, where it gained a huge audience. So the First World War was not only in the news once again, but the prevailing view of the 1960s was that it had been a futile and worthless struggle, a tragedy of immense human proportions acted out in the mud and horror of the trenches, for which the stubborn generals were largely to blame. Richard Dickie Attenborough was then one of the giants of the British cinema, having starred in countless popular movies. However, Oh, What a Lovely War was his directorial debut, and Dickie called in favours from many close friends such as Laurence Olivier, Ralph Richardson, John Gielgud, John Mills and Kenneth Moore, who all agreed to appear in his film, with the result that Dickie was able to raise the substantial budget needed for his first film as director. He decided to shoot much of the film in Brighton, and filming was done in and around the city in 1968, and followed the original idea of setting the musical in a seaside show. Much of the film was shot at Brighton's West Pier, which was taken over, restored and repainted. Sadly, it is now, of course, just a derelict shell. The opening scenes show the leaders of Europe posing for a photograph. Ralph Richardson is Sir Edward Grey, John Gielgud the Austrian Count Berchtold, Ian Holm, President Poincaré, and Kenneth Moore, Kaiser Wilhelm. When the camera shoots the picture, Archduke Ferdinand and his wife fall dead. The leaders then pace around the map of Europe, acting out the process by which Europe went to war in a matter of weeks, partly as a result of political alliances, and partly because, once military call-up had begun, it was impossible to stop. The film then moves to the Brighton seafront, where a band attracts crowds who flock onto the West Pier, where a show called World War One is about to start. General Haig, played by John Mills, sells tickets, and the audience are introduced to the Smith family, whose story provides the centre point of the film. In general terms, the film moves chronologically through the war, beginning with dancing French marionettes, all of whom are then massacred by German machine guns. This is followed by a satire on the recruitment process of 1914, with the Smith family packed into the music hall to watch a show in which a group of girl dancers sing, "We don't want to lose you, but we think you ought to go." At this point, Maggie Smith enters as a young glamorous lead, singing, "On Saturday I'm willing, if you only take a shilling, to make a man of any one of you." Then a recruiting sergeant marches on stage and calls on young men in the audience to come forward. All the Smith family rush on stage, where an over-made-up Maggie Smith hands them over to the recruiting sergeant, who marches them off bawling, "You horrible little men!" The story then moves on to the run-up to the Battle of the Mons, with Laurence Olivier as Sir John French, the CNC of the British Expeditionary Force, in the back of a staff car, with Michael Redgrave as Sir Henry Wilson. Sir Laurence Olivier only has a small part in the film, but he hams it up wildly, and in a scene tells Wilson that they must not worry about the French, as they all come from trade, and in any case, no one can understand them as they speak a foreign language. The Battle of Mons takes place. The wounded return to Waterloo Station, in reality Brighton Station, and there are then several memorable songs, including "We're Here Because We're Here" and "Pack Up Your Troubles in Your Old Kit Bag." Next, there's a scene in which war profiteers are portrayed at a Christmas party. "We're hoping to get the contractor. Tin hats, you know," says Dirk Bogarde to Susanna York. They look at fireworks, which transition to the trenches, where the German troops sing Silent Night, and the Scottish troops respond with the "It was Christmas Day in the workhouse" variant of Tidings of Comfort and Joy. On Christmas Day itself, the Germans slowly appear in a snowy no-man's land, which in reality was created on the top of the old sheepcoat tip at the top of Wilson Avenue. One by one, the Scottish troops get out of their trenches too. For a brief moment, they swap schnapps, whiskey and cigars, and realise they're all suffering together in the war. Then a set of explosions sees both sides running back to their lines, a scene that is shown in a slow, cautious way and is totally believable as a depiction of the famous Christmas truce. Back to the pantomime with Bertie Smith, Corinne Redgrave, joining up as an officer, prompting the song "Goodbye," performed on a seaside toy train. His mother is left waiting on a real railway station, mourning the departure of her fifth son for the war. Meanwhile, the film shows the senior commanders plotting amongst themselves as Haig takes over from the French as commander-in-chief. John Mills, as Sir Douglas Haig, is one of the central characters in the film, but is shown as an idiot, blind to the mounting losses that are constantly put up at headquarters on a cricket scoreboard. It's suggested that he is perhaps driven by a blinkered religious fervour and a belief that the Allies can win the war, claiming, "The loss of another 300,000 men will lead to really great results, and in the end, the enemy will have 5,000 men, and we will have 10,000 men, and we will have won." In one scene, Haig is seen leading a parade while his staff officers gyrate behind him to the song, "One staff officer jumped right over another staff officer's back." It's actually very funny and mimics the lions led by donkeys claim of the First World War command. There are many powerful scenes in the film. Vanessa Redgrave, who plays Sylvia Pankhurst, is addressing a crowd outside a munitions factory calling for the war's end, but is shouted down. A chaplain, Gerald Sim, preaches a sermon for victory and announces that it is no sin to fight on a Sunday. This scene provides one of the most poignant points in the film, in which the choir sings the hymn, "What a Friend We Have in Jesus," while a lone soldier, Maurice Arthur, sings movingly in counterpart, "When this lousy war is over." By this point, there is rarely a dry eye in the house. Elizabeth Smith, a nurse beautifully played by Angela Thorne, now prepares hospital beds for the arrival of the next batch of dreadfully wounded men. There are many natural-looking scenes in the trenches, which were all filmed at the old Sheepcote Valley rubbish tip, where the smell was apparently truly awful. Men are seen dying in no man's land, while the scoreboard at GHQ notches up 607,000 losses on the Somme, with gains nil. Lastly, Jack Smith, the last of the Smith boys, finds himself back in Mons in November 1918, right where we started. He follows a red tape past the European leaders who are signing the armistice and into poppy-filled fields. In the very moving final moments and dramatic ending to the film, which was shot in Ovingdean beside St. Wolfran's Church, and which you can still watch online on YouTube, we see Jack walk across the poppy-filled hillside until he comes across his dead brothers, and then lays down beside them. The camera cuts to the women and the little girl, who, after having a picnic and picking poppies, she says, "Granny, what did Daddy do in the war?" We then go back to all the Smith brothers laying together, and with just a virtually silent soundtrack of birdsong and gentle wind noise, the shot fades from the dead soldiers to show just a few simple white crosses before pulling out painfully slowly to show a truly dramatic aerial view on which the Smith women and child are running through lines of what eventually become more than 16,000 crosses filling the screen, while a choir sings, "We'll Never Tell Them."
You've been listening to a special Armistice Day edition of At Home This Morning, which has been produced for Brighton's only truly local radio station, Radio Reverb, by Grey Matters Productions, with myself, Chris English, and executive producer, Richard Davis. I'll be back with you on Tuesday with the next edition of our magazine programme, At Home This Morning. But in just 2 hours' time, at the 11th hour of the 11th day of the 11th month, please pause and, for just 1 minute, silently remember those who gave their all, not only 100 years ago, but in every conflict since.